I knew we had created something family-ish when my kids would say, we did pretty good, did we, Dad? Because it was a we thing.
Welcome to the Family Man Show with Todd Wilson. This is the show where we remind dads of what's most important. I'm your host, Scott Moore. Thanks for joining us today. Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Well, Scott, that's pretty good for someone who was almost dead like 2 weeks ago.
About right.
So you're sounding better. Are you feeling a little better?
I am. It's not 100% yet, but yeah, I can breathe pretty much normal all the time now. I just occasionally cough and I'm a little run down still every once in a while, but again, it's almost normal again. So thank
you. Well, I enjoyed listening to your show, and by enjoyed, I don't mean enjoyed, because it was like, it was like
painful.
I was like listening to you from, you were inside the casket. You know? I don't know. And, but by the end, I was ready to get a bunch of dads together and we were going to go march on Washington and maybe, you know, tar and feather Fauci. So, it was good. I enjoyed it. It was fun listening to it. Is it hot down in Cincinnati?
It's smoldering, man.
It is smoldering here. Well, we've got a special guest with us, Rory Groves. Rory's from Minnesota. So is it the snow? I know is not, it has snow, melted. How's it doing?
Melted. Yeah. Now that it's August, the snow is finally gone.
Is it hot up there too?
It can get pretty toasty. Actually, it gets very humid up here in the summer. So it can stay. We're in the 80s and 90s a lot in August.
Right, right, right. So right now it feels super steamy hot. But I know like in Minnesota, like middle September, it starts snowing.
Yeah, it gets pretty cold pretty quick. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Rory, it's good to have you with us. I was going to kind of give a pre-introduction, but I'm not even going to do that. So Rory, why don't you just tell us about yourself and your family?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on the show. I'm really grateful to be a part of it. We got to know you at the last homeschooling conference in South Dakota, the Minnesota homeschooling conference held in South Dakota.
Yeah, I'm still working on that one. Go ahead.
So it was really, really great to get to hear you and was encouraged by a lot of the stuff you shared. So I'm really honored to be part of the show. But my background is that I'm a computer programmer by vocation, by training. I spent the last 20 years doing that. And over the course of that time, I just kind of got a little bit tired of the way that my industry operated, where everything goes obsolete so fast. I mean, I know that's the way of the world right now, but especially in technology, you watch something that you put a lot of work into go obsolete in a couple of years or a couple months even. And so I kind of got the itch to like, is there something that I can do that's going to be around for a little bit longer, you know, and is there something at the time when I started, I was single and, you know, living in an apartment and now I'm married 15 years. We've got 5 kids, you know, I want to, as a dad, I want to be part of my kids' lives. I don't want to just leave them and go do something on my own for 60 hours a week. So I was also kind of interested in if there's something out there that I can do that's more family centric, at least that can involve my family a little bit more. And so anyway, I'm kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but those are some of the things on my mind. Like I said, we live in Minnesota. We moved out to like a small hobby farm about 10 years ago. That was kind of part of the process here, part of the journey. And as we were out here and we were doing a lot of things in the garden and learning to do some farming and getting some animals, we really started to like fall in love with this whole aspect of working together, working on the land, you know, growing food that then we would enjoy and we'd eat in the wintertime when it's cold and you can't grow anything. And so there were so many elements to this that we just really enjoyed. And that's kind of was all wrapped up in my decision to kind of leave the technology world and start looking for something that's more durable. And then I ended up writing a book about it.
And that's where we're going to begin our conversation, because Rory gave me a book or sent me a book shortly after that called Durable Trades. And I'll tell you, I'm given lots of books by lots of different people. And most of those books, you know, I peruse quickly and then Goodwill gets them all. But Rory's has a special place in my bathroom that I have been thumbing through it and reading because I was really intrigued by it. The byline is family-centered economics that have stood the test of time. Not because I think that everybody should go out and get a wood miser log cutter and start harvesting your own logs, or that you all need to, you know, we all need to go out and have goats and chickens. I can barely handle the dog I have now, and I'm waiting for the day where he passes on. But what intrigued me was that, you know, in this weird economy that we have, and everybody's kind of scrambling to hold their position, not just hold their position, but this needed position, because, you know, this global thing, everybody's, you can have your phone made, you know, in China just as easy as here, and but you can't get your hair cut very easily in China. And so I've always been kind of intrigued by that. Or we always need people to cut our grass or do these other things. And Rory had this book that I'm telling you is documented, like it looks like someone's life work. I can't believe you did it, you know, just even in a short period of time. It is super, super thorough, and I think it would make a great resource. So here's my hope. My hope is that dads, that maybe we would see maybe a different way, maybe for some of our children as we're trying to guide them as they get a little bit older. Because, you know, up until now, like even Corey's plan, you know, he was a computer programmer. That was kind of like everybody was expected to do something like that. You know, you went to school, then you went to college, then you got a job doing something like that. Well, you know, there are a lot of other jobs that maybe require training, but a different kind of training. And some of our kids have that bent already. And so I'm super excited. So Rory, why don't we just kind of jump right in there, and we'll start with the title of your book, Durable Trades. Mm-hmm. So what is a durable trade?
Yeah. So durable trade. So like I had talked about earlier, I was very interested in what can I put my time, effort, energy towards that's going to be around for a while? What can I do that's going to last? And this was in the middle, this is before COVID hit and everything, you know, was disrupted around the world, and you couldn't buy toilet paper, and there's all kinds of, you couldn't meet in gatherings. So this is before all of this happened. I was already really researching what would survive disruptions in the past? What kind of professions would be durable for disruptions in the future? So I essentially, what I did is I carved out a period of time because, you know, you hear about some of these people who are third generation farmers, fifth generation farmers, or fourth generation carpenters. And so you have these family businesses that have continued on for centuries, really, when you think about it. And when I dug back a little bit further, you know, that was the normal way of things for pretty much all of human history. You'd have trades which would be passed down generationally from parents to children to grandchildren. You'd have mentorship and apprenticeship, and you'd have a smaller community that was self-sufficient. And today we've grown to the point where everyone is so specialized. And a lot of that comes out of the Industrial Revolution. So that's kind of the area where I started is, are there trades that have survived even through the Industrial Revolution and are still viable for families today as kind of like a marker? Because if it can survive that period of time, basically since our nation's founding, then you know that it's already survived wars and inflation and disruptions and revolutions, and it's already, you know, survived these things. So what I did is I came up with a list of all the professions that were around since the founding of our country, so roughly 1790, and are still around today, and families are still working in them today. And I kind of use that as a list. That there's about 60 trades, so 61 trades in total. And then what I did is I scored them according to criteria. So when you ask what is a durable trade? So I looked at all of these different trades and I said, what is it about these trades that makes them durable? Why do these last when other ones won't? Like, to give you an example, if you go back to, you know, America around the time of the revolution, there were about 70 or so total occupations to choose from in life. Done, right?
And so you're saying that there aren't a lot of button makers right now.
Not a lot of shells. Button looks. There weren't a lot of search engine optimizers. You know, there weren't all these. Right. I mean, so many things. And when the Industrial Revolution came along, that was the whole emphasis of it, was let's specialize everything. You know, so they had children that used to be working on the farm with their families, standing in a coal mine, opening and shutting a door all day for 12 hours a day. For 6 days a week. That was their specialization. And, you know, fortunately, we don't have that kind of dehumanizing jobs as often today. A lot of that's been automated, but there's still a lot of reduction in the terms of the kind of skills needed to perform a task. It used to be general, a lot more generalists. Now we're a lot more specialists. So anyway, today we have over 30,000 occupations to choose from. So what are you going to do? There's so many different possibilities out there. And just for me, like I said before, the main things that I wanted to know were what's durable, what's going to be around for a while and not go obsolete right away. And secondly, what can I do with my family? Because to me, ultimately, work is meant to support my family. Mm. It's not something that is the goal of my life is to work. I want to raise children. I want to raise godly offspring. I want to bring these souls to heaven with me. And if work can be a way to help me disciple my kids, then that's the kind of work I want to be doing.
Mm-hmm. And that's really what interested me about your categories. And really you've broken it down, and we're going to put this to the test here and show them how it works. You have like historical stability, resiliency, family centeredness, which I just think is, you know, that's why we're talking, because I love jobs that are good for families. They're good for, because there are a lot of jobs where you might make a lot of money, but you don't get to see your family. And that's a lose kind of job. Then income and ease of entry. So like you said, you had 61 different categories. And if you take out the one that you did about writers, which was totally wrong, I mean, like you made it sound like it was easy and you could make a living at it. That's a lot of categories. And like you said, like I was trying to say, is that, you know, some of the durable trades that they did back then, we don't have a need for. You know, we don't have a need for someone who makes petticoats now, or not a very big need.
Yeah, shoemakers used to be an individualized job, and that's basically not. That's completely been eliminated through industrialism. Yeah.
Right. And so how about you just give us, you know, because again, we can't cover them all. How about you give us some of your favorites and maybe look at those five categories and share how that might
sure. work out. So well, let me start with the categories. So I came up with these categories: historical stability. So basically how much has the profession changed over the last 200 years? Resiliency, which is how does it do to short-term shocks in the system. So like what we just went through in 2020, that would be considered, you know, jobs that did well through that would be considered resilient. Family centeredness, that's how many opportunities are there for your family to work together in the trade. So not just make a lot of money and then you can be home with your family in the off hours, but can the trade be something that's home-based? Can children work in the trade? Can elderly people work in the trade? Are there roles that husbands and wives can work together in a complementary way? And then does it generate assets that can be inherited by your children? Some of these professions are all knowledge work and there's really nothing there other than a book value. But some of them create, just over the course of time, they create very tangible assets that are valuable to your children. And then income. So this is, you know, most career guides, if you were to call it that, they're ranking based on income. Income makes up 1/5 of the score. So, you know, you need to be able to earn a living. But my point with this is that that's not everything. You know, really the highest ranking category is family centeredness. And then lastly, ease of entry. So what are their barriers to entry? Do you have to have a lot of education? Are there a lot of government regulations? Is there
startup costs?
Yeah, right. Sunk cost to get started in it. Oh, and I should mention under one of the categories, resiliency, is the potential for automation. How likely is this job going to be automated, taken over by robots in the near future? So those are kind of all combined. There's five main categories and then there's subcategories. And I ranked everything as objectively as I could. And then I wrote about each of the trades in the book so that you get a profile and kind of an objective score and some ideas about where to get started if you are interested in any of these trades.
And really in all, and I think, I don't know if it's every chapter, but you kind of have or lots of them, you have maybe a personal story at the end of the chapter that someone who's doing it. And that's, I thought was really encouraging as well.
Yeah. So I interviewed, so for the top 20, most of the book is centered around the top 20 trades that as they kind of were scored. And I interviewed someone working in those trades for all of those chapters. And just to kind of give like, what's a day in the life like? What are some of the challenges? You know, what's some advice you would give to someone starting in this trade? So I tried to be as helpful as I could in that way. And then the other question you asked was about what are some of the favorites? Well, you know, this started simply as just for my own family. I wasn't trying to write a book when I sat down to do this. I just wanted to answer the question. Like, what are my options? Mm-hmm. I want to work with my family. I want to do something that's meaningful, something that's going to last. So I don't want to do a hot dog stand, but I don't know exactly what are my options. So that's simply where I started. And so for me, I'm just looking at the research. And the thing I notice is that food, fiber, and shelter rank at the top of the list. So basically trades that are catering to core human needs, right? Food, fiber, and shelter. Those are the ones that stay around no matter what. And they may have, you know, carpenters, they may go through a recession and carpenters may lose their job. But as soon as people need a builder again, those jobs come right back. So they have the most staying power. And that's actually really of most interest to me. Secondly, it just so happens that trades that operate with food, fiber, and shelter or cater to these core human needs, they're also the most family centered. It just happens to be that way. So it's almost like there's kind of a hint there that, you know, if you're providing a deeply needed service or product for people, there's opportunities to work together as a family in those services. It's not something that machines are going to be able to take away from you, or China or outsourcing anywhere else is going to be able to take that opportunity away from you, but you're going to be able to work with your family and you'll be able to pass on that business if your children want to continue in it. And so people have done that for centuries.
Why don't you just pick one and let's look at it with those. And again, dad's, he may mention one, you know, and you're like, you're kidding me, right? Like, yeah, I'm going to do that. This is not, that's not the point right here. The point here is just to see how it works. And this is like 60 trays he has in here. So I would guess that, you know, if you were interested.
So one that's kind of interesting is Innkeeper. And I kind of use the old timey names for a lot of these. So you'll see things like Apothecary and Innkeeper and. But, it, you know, someone who's basically opening up a place for people for lodging. They could be someone who owns a hotel or someone who owns an Airbnb. And so for that chapter, I interviewed someone who opened their house up as an Airbnb. And that was their family business. And there's a whole resurgence in this category now because of opportunities for people to lodge in homes and for that to be facilitated through these websites. So that's one that ranks in at number 10.
And then how does that, so walk through the five, like maybe the historical stability, how does that rank there?
Okay, so historical stability ranks at 84% out of obviously 100 being the best. And resiliency, 63%, family centeredness, 67%, income, 80%, ease of entry, 64%. So in other words, you would have the core trade of lodging people and the people needing lodging hasn't changed that much in 200 years. I mean, it's basically the same service. It's something that does get affected. Tourism does get affected in recessions, but it's still a very strong, resilient trade that people are going to need these things pretty much come what may. There's a lot of opportunities for families to work together in that trade. I mean, it's home-based, which is a huge factor in family-centeredness. Is this something you can open up at home? I mean, it can be home-based. I shouldn't say that it's always home-based. Income at 80%, that means people can make on average up to say maybe $80,000 a year, $60,000 to $80,000 a year doing these kinds of things. You'd probably be more in the neighborhood of half that if you're just opening up one unit. But if you had multiple units, which oftentimes these people will have multiple units, they can really make a lot of income doing that. And then lastly, you do need some capital to get started, obviously. I mean, you could start with your own house. You could try to borrow money to get started, but there is going to be some capital involved. But now on the other side of that, you live you leaving behind significant assets for your children. I mean, it's land, it's real estate. That's a pretty significant thing. So as long as you're not over leveraged, that can be a very valuable family business and it can last for generations.
Hmm. Well, you've already kind of started this, started at number 10. What's number nine?
Oh, okay. We're doing it. Number nine is Brewer. Now, this is probably one of the most ancient of family businesses. There's actually wineries that go back for 10 centuries over in Europe, and they're still in the same family. Mm-hmm. But anyone kind of brewing or distilling or making wines, those are incredibly durable professions. We have a family friend out in California that they just started. They bought a farm out there some number of years ago and planted vineyards. And it's just, it's very slowly making its way in, but they're looking forward to being able to make wine off their own produce and off their own land. And their kids are involved with every aspect except for drinking it.
Well, and you got to pick a good name, like the Wooden Cricket or the Lopsided Hog or something like that. How about number eight? Oh, go ahead.
Well, no, one other thing I'll add is microbreweries are kind of part of the reason this has had a huge resurgence. So there's an opportunity for smaller players now that wasn't there even maybe 20, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot more interest in that. Okay, number eight is Cook. So anyone who's involved with preparing food, whether it's a restaurateur or it's a catering service or it's just food preparation and meal preparation goes all the way back.
Now, would that include like specialty things? Like I just saw a post where, you know, some family was making cookies and they were really fancy cookies and they were shrink wrapping them and sending them out. Or is that another category?
Yeah, I mean, it can be as broad or narrow as you want. I mean, it could be something in a restaurant where you're actually operating a restaurant, which would be, of course, its own source of income. But then you're also opening yourself up to additional vulnerability in a recession because people tend not to eat out as much. Whereas catering services, you're more home-based. If it's something like what you're talking about, people making cookies and sending those out, that sounds like something you could do from home. And then you can be more involved with your family in that. And so, yeah, I would, any kind of food preparation would fall under that category.
Okay. How about number seven?
Number seven is painter. So this one, I interviewed a guy who left a job. He was a director level executive for a company out here in Southern Minnesota. He left that job and went into full-time exterior painting. And that's what he does now. And he loves it. And he says the first year they took a hit, they relocated, they moved to a smaller house. But then after that, the business just kept coming and coming and coming. And now he involves his whole family. His wife helps keep the books, you know, and doing some of the marketing for it. And then he's out there as busy as can be, and he's making more money than he was as a director level executive.
And really what I think is cool is that, like, even when, you know, when you think about involving your family, sometimes it doesn't mean every single family member is out, loading the truck and they're all painting on the same house. But does mean that dads can do it with maybe older kids or, you know, younger kids have a part when they play. And I'll tell you, even in what I do, traveling around and speaking, you know, I knew we had created something family-ish when my kids would say, we did pretty good, did we, Dad? Because it was a we thing, or we didn't do so well that day, night, did we, Dad? Because it was a we thing. And I really like that part. Well, Rory, I know we're going to run out of time. So how about go up to the number three and then we'll do two and one.
Yeah. Number three is midwife. So here is a profession that, you know, you go all the way back to the earliest days in the Bible. You have Moses being born and the midwives were attending, and it says the midwives did not listen to the Pharaoh because they feared God. So they let Moses live. But midwifery has not been as common in the U.S. recently. And I say that like within maybe the last century, but it's extremely common in the rest of the world. And it's been making a strong comeback in the U.S. And a lot of people that we even know personally have had all their kids through midwives. And it's a very, very strong profession, especially for women.
If that's not so good for men.
Yeah. Not as a lot of male midwives in there. But it is a very viable option for women. Yeah. Number two is farmer. And farmer, for the purposes of this book, farmer is anyone who's doing crop farming. So basically putting seeds in the ground and cultivating the land in that way. And that is the second most durable trade. And it's not number one only because it has seen so much change to the core profession in the last century. I mean, tractors weren't even around 100 years ago. Well, they're just starting to show up 100 years ago. It's hard to even imagine cultivating the soil with a team of oxen and a guy walking behind with the plow, but that's for thousands of years, that's exactly what they did. And there are still many, many different types of farmers. So today we have conventional farmers who are doing, you know, with the large thousands of acres with lots of equipment. And then you have organic farmers who are farming by hand. Maybe they use some tractors, but they're essentially growing food for local restaurants. And they, or they have CSAs, so community supported agriculture. Those have exploded in recent decades. And there are a number of, pretty much in any town, there's a number of different organic farms, CSA operations that are all home-based, family-centered, and people are definitely making a living doing that.
Mm. How about number one?
Number one is Shepherd.
That was a shocker to me. Because as if I'm a dad, like, I'm not getting goats. I'm not getting goats, Rory. I'm just not.
Well, again, I want to use the term broadly, but basically animal husbandry is the most durable, most family-centered trade of all time. We go back to Cain and Abel leaving the garden, right? What did it say? Cain cultivated the earth and Abel kept flock. So, I mean, it goes all the way back. And there's something unique about working with animals, and farmers and shepherds know this, that there is a bond that is created between the shepherd and his flock. And it's very difficult to automate that. You can try to put a drone out there, and I know that they're trying to work on ways to automate that, but it's hard to automate the process of actually caring for animals because they're living beings and they need very unique kinds of care, particularly in the realm of fencing. Mm-hmm. So my wife likes to say that that's all that it is it's just about fencing. But yeah, so when I use the term broadly, I mean, anyone who's involved in animal husbandry, this could be someone who's just breeding puppies.
Oh, and I was even going to mention that because I know some people, like we have a mom friend who's a single mom, and she did a litter of puppies because they were selling for $2,000 a piece. Absolutely. And it was a way to do, and even my daughter business. Said, Dad, we should do it. I'm like, no, we're not going to get puppies.
Hey, don't knock until you tried it. Okay, Todd.
I've tried one.
Seriously, though, there is a huge demand. Now, that demand may not persist after COVID kind of dies down or things go back, well, whatever normal we're going back to. But there's been a massive demand for pets just in the last year and a half. And people who are already in that line of work, I mean, they'll tell you they've never had such demand in their entire history.
Yeah.
So there's lots of different ways you can raise animals for food. We can raise them for fiber. You can raise them for breeding, for pets, for other people to start farming. There's all kinds of opportunities there with animals. And the other thing about it is you don't need thousands of acres. We have about a dozen sheep and five goats and a bunch of chickens and some other things. We live on 10 acres and we can actually feed them all year long by grazing in the pasture and then cutting hay for the winter. And so it's very economical. They multiply on their own. I mean, there's all kinds of advantages there. And mostly one of the things I like about it is there's so many opportunities for my children to be involved in that kind of work. So my five-year-old collects the eggs from the chickens, but my 10-year-old is, you know, feeding hay to the sheep out in the barn. And all along the way, there's a lot of different varieties of options available for any people of any age to contribute in that kind of a business.
Okay, we're going to run out of time here, but there are two people to talk to. One is maybe the dad who, you know, maybe he has a child who, you know, is interested in animals or interested in building things with their hands. How would you maybe begin to foster that, you know, so that they might be able to support their family somehow in the future?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the things, like, this book basically proves that these are viable options and many people make livings on these careers today and will continue to do so. So just because someone doesn't get a four-year college degree, for example, doesn't mean that they won't be able to support their family. Actually, the you talk to the people in the building trades, they are making more than I did as a computer programmer. So it's not always the right choice for everyone just to go to college and follow that same route. Mm-hmm. They should seriously explore trades. And more importantly, I would really encourage someone, if they see a child that has a propensity towards something, if you yourself don't also share that, like oftentimes it runs in the family. If you're a woodworker, which is number four on the list, oftentimes your children will pick up that from you by watching what you did. But if you're not into the kind of activity that your kids are in, I would seriously look for mentors who can provide some kind of instruction at a young age. Give them a chance to work in the trade long before they have to choose a career, you know, mm-hmm. to explore that and see if that's an option. You could check for people in your church or in your local community, or even, you know, if you want to do classes, there's various places where you can get instruction on that kind of thing. But definitely get some hands-on experience long before you have to make the call about going to college or choosing a profession. And you'll know, I mean, if this is something that the kid sticks with and shows interest, then you'll be able to move them in that direction. Mm.
And what a great thing to encourage your child in a direction that they feel bent towards, as opposed to, you need to go do this because this is...
You know, just because something's marketable doesn't mean that it's the right fit. Mm. You know, God gave us these children. He put them in our family. And it is our responsibility as parents to really be preparing them and to be considering prayerfully, what gifts has God given this person? Mm-hmm. What are their aptitudes? And you can see those things from a very early age. And my son is, he's already using power tools to build tree houses. Now, not the saws. I don't let him use saws, but he can use the impact driver. But, he's 10. I didn't use a power tool till I was 35. You know, I was sitting in a computer, in a bedroom on a computer my whole life and playing video games and wasting all that time. Here he is, he's building tree houses, and he'll be, you know, if anyone lets him in, he'll be the first one on the building site climbing up on the scaffolding. So, that's definitely my role as a father is what are his aptitudes? What are my daughter's aptitudes? And then is there a way that I can get them started in a hands-on way and an education in that?
And how about the dad who's listening right now? And he's like, you know, I like what you're talking about, not just for my kids, but maybe for me, but I don't know what I can do. You know, how would you begin down that? I mean, obviously, and I will say this, pick up Rory's book, Durable Trades, and he'll tell you where you can get it in just a second. But how would you encourage that dad?
So I've talked to a lot of dads in the course of writing this book and then after it was published. And there are so many dads out there that want a different path, for example, than the one they're on. They don't want to climb a corporate ladder. They don't want to spend their life in the office. They want to be with their families, they want to be discipling their kids, they want to be doing something that's meaningful. It's not just about the paycheck. And I think that if that's a dad out there listening right now, I would say to that dad, you need to stop and pray and seek the Lord for what your first step should be. Because if God's put this in your heart, there's a reason. There's a reason he's brought this shift into your family. And so prayerfully consider beginning the journey towards a different line of work and see then is there something out there that you can do right now? You don't have to quit. I don't encourage anybody to quit their day job and buy a farm after they read my book. Although I have had more than one person say that they bought farms after reading my book, but only because they were already feeling persuaded in that direction. But move slowly and then take one step at a time. But anything, I truly believe this, that you can do together with your family is going to yield blessings. Mm-hmm. If you can open a lemonade stand, if you can open a hot dog stand, if you can grow some flowers and sell them on the side of the road, anything that you guys can do together just to get the experience of working together, I believe that it's truly blessed by God, that God wants families to work together. That's how he designed the families originally. And that to the extent that you are able to move in that direction, you're going to find blessing and there's going to be fruit from it.
Amen. Amen. Well, hey, Rory, we're out of time. Why don't you, if somebody wanted to contact you or get your book, what's the best way to do that?
come to our website, thegrovestead.com. And we have the book is listed there with some coupon codes, or you can get the book pretty much anywhere books are sold. So Amazon. We also have a newsletter that we publish as a family just to kind of follow along on some of the things that we're doing, trying to build a family economy out here. So that would be the best place to start.
Okay. Well, Rory, it has been a pleasure talking to you. And again, just encourage you dads, if you want something that is well-documented, well thought through and researched, and if you're like, you like graphs and things like that and percentages, this is the book for you because he really puts it out there, spells it all out, and it's really thought through. And I'm hoping that maybe it would encourage you, maybe as a dad, as you parent your child, or maybe God would even use it to move you to something that he's already kind of put in your heart. So, Rory, thanks for being with us.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Todd.
And that's our show for this week, Dad. Thanks for joining us for the Family Man Show with Todd Wilson. If you have a question for the show, email Todd at familyman@familymanweb.com. If you have a question for me, you can reach me at scott@unsocializedmedia.com. Thanks for joining us, Dad. Have a great week.
So Scott, you know, I mean, you said it was kind of hard. How hard was it? Was your family worried for you? Were they?
Yeah, my wife was freaking out.
They cleaning out the room so they could make space?
My son Will was practicing unplugging the machines. He likes to tease me with that every once in a while.
Dad, should I say this or do you want this song sung?
Yeah, he's the designated unplugger. Like when we have to pull the plug on Dad, Will's going to do it. So
it's good to have someone like that.
He gets a little eager sometimes, but you know.
That's right. I'm not dying.
But yeah, my wife was pretty freaked out. She didn't sleep well at all for a couple of nights there. And the worst night was probably when we came back from the hospital because I wasn't quite feeling better yet, even though they had done the infusion of antibodies. It was the next morning that I started feeling better. But we got this little blood oximeter thing, the little thing they put on your finger, you know, to check your blood oxygen level. Well, she was trying to do that to me while I was sleeping. And I was sleeping on the floor in the basement on my face, basically, like on my stomach. Because apparently that helps your lungs. If you're into respiratory therapy, that helps your lungs to deal with the pneumonia. So I'm laying in the most uncomfortable position I can be in just about. I mean, I haven't slept like that since I was a kid. Anyway, I wake up in the middle of the night and my wife is laying there trying to take my pulse ox reading. And I almost punched her. I was really not happy about that. I was like, I don't care what it is. I'm not going back to that hospital. Then she was freaking out and worried. And, you know, it was not fun that night. And the couple nights leading up to that really weren't fun. I didn't sleep much, which is ultimately why I ended up going back to the hospital. So, or going to the hospital in the first place. But
Right.
Anyway.
Well, I'm glad we have a happy story to tell at the end.
Yeah, me too. Well, there's plenty of not so happy ones out there. We know a family where the dad's been on a ventilator for a few weeks already, and it's not looking good. Yeah. So we keep praying. And it's just
I just don't know that because you don't know if it's like does it get so bad because and they have to put him on a ventilator or is it get so bad because they are on a ventilator? I just don't know.
I hear you, and that was actually. In retrospect, one of my concerns, I think I mentioned this last week, that it really felt like their whole treatment plan was just to tell me I should have got the vaccine and basically sit there and monitor my oxygen levels to see if they'd go low enough that they could admit me and then, you know, maybe eventually stick me on a ventilator. I really don't like to feel that way, but it's hard not to think
that. It felt a little bit like that. Well, that's like what I was saying, you know, I mean, I don't know. Maybe a doctor would say, see, well, that's because, you know, if you're riding your bike real fast like that. And so we're not going to, It's all your fault that you broke your leg.
Right.
You know, I mean, or you drove a car too fast. I mean, nobody's, I don't know that they've done that in the past, but it does feel a little bit like now that they're making a moral call and almost saying, well, since you didn't do what we told you to, we're not going to help you.
And it wouldn't have felt so much like that if, like I mentioned on the last week's show, if when I asked them about other treatments, like I know they've used high dose steroids and things like that for pneumonia before and to some varying degrees of success and whatever, if they hadn't basically laughed at me when I said that, that was when the doctor just looked at me and said, well, if that stuff worked, we'd all be rich and no one would be in the hospital. So you just need to trust the science. I mean, that's a direct quote.
Man. Those kind of things that a parent would say when they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like, well, I'm your dad.
You know? That was literally, now that I think of it, that was the point that really tipped me over the edge to feeling hostile. And like, I was like, I'm getting out of this hospital today.
Yeah.
I don't care what they say. That did not make me happy. But
anyway. Well, we have a guy in our church right now who's on a ventilator. And really, the way they talked, it was almost like, they put him on a ventilator because he was so anxious, almost like because they were talking about putting him on a ventilator and he knew that was almost like a death sentence and they knocked him out basically. And, you know, to put him on that and gave him whatever, kind of a coma inducing medication. But he is recovering a little bit. So we're hoping that God will be gracious and allow this come to an end. But
well, and I don't want to sound like I'm anti all medical people. That's the thing. I think a lot of them really care and are trying really hard and they're exhausted from trying to do this whole thing for the last year and a half or whatever. And I think that a lot of them are really frustrated because they're having such a difficult time with this. I think that again, I don't want to get too much on my soapbox, but it does seem like they've centralized all medical care to the CDC. And if you violate their protocols, you're not doing it right. And they won't even let them violate their protocols. No. I mean, that's so frustrating to me. It almost makes me want to run for office.
Well, it's so interesting to me because I just heard someone on the radio say, well, you know, since we were all wearing masks and social distancing, that this year's regular flus and regular common colds will probably be worse because the lady said, because we're really kind of designed to give each other immunity by getting this diseases. And I'm like, do you see how this is coming back to bite us? You know, kind of like giving people money and causes inflation and all these things. Whenever it seems like the government involves itself.
Yep.
It comes back some way you didn't anticipate it. But hey, enough about that. I'm glad you're feeling better.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next week.
And I'm going to be a shepherd now. So I won't be here anymore. I'm getting some sheep.
And you've already got your towel over your head.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I could not be a shepherd because I don't like animals. So at all.
Yep.
So see ya.
Bye-bye.